Hello and welcome to the Parallax Podcast, the Movie Debate Podcast, featuring myself, Luke Buckmaster, and my esteemed co-host, Mr. Rich Harrity. Rich.
Hello, that's me.
This episode, we continue our series of inviting notable Australians to join us for a film topic of their choice and corresponding titles for them, and of course, many more along the way.
It's our pleasure to be joined by a man who burst onto the Australian media scene in 1997. He's starred in and created numerous TV shows and maintained a colourful profile, known for such things as
getting into a rather memorable argy-bargy with Ray Martin,
drinking peyote and vomiting in the desert,
undergoing an exorcism and talking in tongues,
sniffing an extensive collection of ladies' underwear,
locking David Irving in a room and feeding a gas pipe into it,
posing as a black man and preaching in an American church,
putting a fatwa on Rove McManus,
attempting to join a branch of the Ku Klux Klan.
And we could probably keep going on, but I'm sure you've guessed who it is by now.
He's the creator of TV shows such as John Safran vs. God and John Safran's Race Relations, and host of Triple J's weekly radio show / podcast Sunday Night Safran. And I've completely forgotten his name.
He is, of course, that Mr. John Safran. Thank you for joining us, John.
Shalom. Thank you for inviting me here to this flat on the first floor that overlooks a mad little music lesson shop.
In an undisclosed Melbourne-based location that may or may not be Melbourne.
Just very atmospheric. I reckon it's good. I reckon when you get older, you're going to look back at this time in your life.
These are the times.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't mention Stavrob's mechanics, which is just next door. But apparently they're qualified, as all good mechanics are. Every episode, John, every guest episode, yes, we invite someone to, you know, choose a topic of their choice. Do you want to outline to us what topic you've selected and why?
Documentaries that raise issues of truth and ethics, and particularly older ones. I like everyone. A lot of people seem to think documentaries, especially ones with a protagonist in it, you know, where the filmmaker's in front of the camera, maybe started around, you know, Michael Moore's time. But there's ones that go back earlier that are just fascinating and, you know, a bit buried and not overly spoken about. So, and when you watch these ones going back as early as the 60s, you're kind of blown away and realize there's nothing new under the sun.
And has,
and especially not only nothing new in regards to, you know, technology, or nothing new in regards to, you know, having a, you know, the filmmaker as part of the documentary, but nothing new as in regards to like ethical considerations and regards to tricks you play and in regards to what you try to get away with as a documentary maker.
Has this been a issue that's been with you for a while, or just since you've started practicing it yourself, is that when this became kind of...
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely, because my background is, I never particularly watched films or, I mean, I watched films like Raiders of the Lost Ark, but not documentaries when I grew up, or even thought I was going to ever get into it. And then I kind of intersected with this thing called Race Around the World, which was this competition on the ABC where they wanted young filmmakers or young people to send in little documentaries. And just in the same way as, you know, 5 years earlier, I auditioned for Red Faces and I tried to form a band once, and I made a board game once, and I tried to do a comic strip. I tried to learn how to be an animator. Like, that was my entire school, like, mindset. It was just like, oh, I'll kind of try to do this. And then it kind of worked and I got further opportunities, and then I became a documentary filmmaker of sorts, of obviously the of sorts,
and the
ethical has a lot of footnotes to it, but yes. But one of the things was, when I went into Race Around the World, I was really a bit kind of thrown back by tricks and things that aren't that malicious, or it was just like, oh, this isn't the truth. We went on this thing called Race Around the World University, I guess, where it was like 4 weeks where we learned how to be filmmakers, and, you know, at the Australian Film Blah.
Film Academy
in Sydney. And I did this, I went to an abattoir because I've always had a flavour for, you know, a bit of hype and tabloid or whatever. And I went there to see how the halal slaughtering process is done. And then when the guy was cutting it together back at the ABC, this was just for the university, not for broadcasting or whatever, I watched how he cut it together, and he'd put like the sounds of moos over the cattle kind of going up the ramp to be slaughtered. And I was like, hang on, what was that? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, because you had the sound of the moos from outside when the cows are just mooing in the grass when you filmed them before. So I just took that and plonked it here. Mm. And I was like, what is that's not right. I was like, it really threw me. And so, yeah, but then obviously you get used to it and then you start wanting to play around with it. And then you start seeing that there's pros to it. Like maybe the world's better to have little tricksters, little P.T. Barnums out there trying to fudge things around to make life more interesting. So, yes. Generally, I kind of just make the rule of, oh, if people found out about this, would they feel ripped off or not? And often and often they wouldn't.
Yeah. Cool. And talking about what you can and can't do ethically, and talking about films that have been maybe buried or not appreciated as much, and films that haven't really aged as much or have some tactics that are still employed these days.
Yeah.
One of the films that you've listed is completely new to me, and I was absolutely blown away by it. The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On from 1987.
Yes.
And I don't think you'd seen the film.
No, it had been on my radar for quite some time, but yeah, it was kind of like that Japanese documentary from the 80s that runs almost by over 2 hours, and you know, it wasn't something that I felt I needed to see, but we both watched it separately over the last week and were blown away by it. It was quite an amazing film.
Basically, the premise is that it's about a veteran from the Japanese military from the Second World War campaign in New Guinea. He's a 62-year-old at the time. His name is Kenzo Okazaki. What is it? Help me, Rich.
Okazaki.
And he basically desperately wants to find answers to who killed two of his wartime colleagues after the war had finished. So he goes around interrogating a whole bunch of military superiors or former military superiors 40 years after the event. And he doesn't really take no for an answer in terms of hot-headed people trying to discover the truth. And this guy just takes it to another level.
And probably the cool thing to emphasize is if you imagine one of those Michael Moore films where Michael Moore just kind of pushes himself into, you know, this corporation or that corporation. This is like that, except done earlier before Michael Moore. And it's this guy who's not a filmmaker who apparently was doing this even when he wasn't filmed. And, yeah, going this old guy just going around creating all these awkward situations that are the equivalent of what Michael Moore does, but in Japan. And it's about, you know, trying to find out about his killed colleagues and who's responsible and why have these Japanese soldiers that out there had done that and why are they now just allowed to go back to their lives? And he just walks into like little restaurants and
cafes, restaurants, and he makes like there's a certain point in this film where you realize that the protagonist, for want of a better word, is actually a bit of a psychopath. And some of the things that he says to people, he says, "Today I've come here prepared to beat you up, I mean it." He says, "I won't let you leave this room, even if it's illegal." You know, and he actually beats up his interviewees.
Yep. There's several beatings occur in the film.
Like a pansy.
It is. It's totally insane in the best possible way. I did read the little notes that came with the DVD. I bought this because I found it in this bin when I was overseas, at a DVD shop, and it had like some little blurb on the front. I really like this film, Michael Moore, so I thought I'd take it and read it. And with the little blurb that's not in the film, the filmmaker explains that the guy actually was a lot madder than he has put it together, because for the sake of the documentary had more power if you just think this guy's, you know, a bit of a normal guy, when really I think the filmmaker would say he's more the equivalent of some, you know, as some kind of slightly strange person that wanders the streets and rants
some
about
psychotic,
Freemasons planting.
Any if you don't give
Yeah, well, I found that really interesting because, the filmmaker did say that he cut the film to make Okazaki like an action hero. The filmmaker liked Hollywood films and he cut it to make him this action hero. And you see these scenes where he storms into houses and it's like Jack Bauer in 24 sitting him down going, "Give me the answers." And this idea of editing, creating a story, did that resonate with you in terms of how you represent the truth?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, well, so much usually is going on in a situation, and you only want to tell one story because you can't, like, tell everything.
Yeah.
So a good example of that that always happens to me is I'll go into a church situation or a mosque situation, and as well as the ritual that I want to explore, there'll also be this side story of the guy's a bit of a scammer, and he's always, like, hitting on his congregants.
Yeah.
You know, to try, in this way that's totally uncomfortable and sleazy and, I guess, kind of interesting, maybe, but it's like, I want to tell the story of the exorcism.
Yeah.
I've got 30 minutes. I can't tell the story of the exorcism and also have this other thing. Like, it's just, you know, I'd sacrifice too much. So
yeah, so you can never tell kind of this complete, truthful portrayal of everything.
You got to pick your story. And the other thing is, I would say so often, what you cut out is out of empathy. Well, you know, you've got your agenda, you want to tell a story, but it's like, it's making people look bad. So yeah. I reckon most of what I cut out would be, or a lot of, like, you go to Africa and people are, like, really desperate and hitting you on up you for money, and sort of like, you know, if you put that to air, you'd just be making them, like, there's no interest for me to put it in.
Yeah, but have you actually put something in and then copped a bit of a response to it and then later regretted the edit or included in the first place?
Not in that case, but usually it's like, often it's empathy that makes you leave things out. Like, it's like, oh, that person doesn't want that side of them seen, or it's, you've sort of organised it a bit beforehand. Especially in poor countries, usually the big thing they don't like is, like, presenting them as pitiful. So whenever I do, like, go somewhere and do a religious ritual, you know, in the third world, usually there was all this really confusing and upsetting and pitiful stuff going on around, and it's like, chop, 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 chop. So is that, like, the documentary maker not representing the truth, or is that the documentary maker sort of saying to these people, you know, I want to, you know, I don't want to present these people in a pitiful way because they don't want to.
Yeah, and if that logic were actually applied to The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On, I would love to see what they didn't put in this film.
Yeah, no.
Because there are actually scenes where he attacks a person who can't control his bladder anymore, can't walk properly,
yes,
an old man,
yeah,
demanding answers. You know, it's sort of, I think the question for me, the key question is, sort of comes down to whether the ends justify the means and whether it's okay to put people in these situations and maybe even deceive them along the way if you make a final statement at the end. And in race relations, you know,
yes,
you've got the classic episode where you not only do a blackface, you do, what's it, a black body?
Yeah.
I don't know what you'd call it. And you pretend to be a black man.
Yeah.
And you obviously deceive a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
And you go to church, you talk about how you raise white, and the only people who really get that joke, and the message I think is very much against racism, so it's a good point to make, but the only people who really get that are the audience at home.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a question of whether it's okay to deceive some people if there's actually a reward or a point that you've made at the end.
Yeah, I think it's all, it's not like a zero-sum game, so it's like, just say with me annoying Ray Martin, there's a dimension to that where I'm upsetting him by being on the lawn and, you know, it's not comfortable and it's like, it's not nice really. And I was there and...
For you or for him?
Oh, for him. Like, but you sort of, you say, well, considering this or that, what, and, you know, when it all comes out in the wash. But I'd say with the blackface episode, the issue, a lot of the issue is like what was left on the cutting room floor, and for that whole series, for better or worse, but I'm beginning to think for worse, we cut things within an inch of their lives to make everything look unforgivable, because it was like trying to be really like anti-pious. So therefore, you know, rather than having the scene where, for instance, the people in the scene find out that you are someone else, and they don't care, rather than putting that in the final thing, leaving that on the cutting room
floor. So the characters actually, well, the people did find out that you were
often.
Well, because there was right, notably no reveal in the actual episode.
So that was possibly, I mean, it was intentional at the time. Not just for that thing, but for the entire series. We try to make everything really uncomfortable and disorienting and unforgivable. And, you know, like for instance, when I pretend to my friends that I'm getting married, and then I don't get married, and then my friends are really upset for a minute, but then like 3 minutes later they're not upset, but you know, so but I don't put in that bit because I just want to make it disorienting for the audience.
But and that makes sense to not put that bit in.
Yeah,
it
is,
it would alleviate some of the velocity and the
yeah, you know? Definitely. But Yeah, but there is... You definitely get away with more when people kind of really understand your satirical point a lot better. And then when you kind of go into these areas of slightly more uncomfortable performance art, which I guess a bit of that show was, like, yeah, people can really take it the wrong way. And sometimes it's just good to have... I've noticed people like signifiers that something's going on that they can get their head around. Like, just say Borat. I actually don't... I think Borat's brilliant, that film. Like, so good.
Mm.
But I don't actually think it exposes all these people as racists, like the film purports to. It exposes what happens when you go into a place about how much people will try to be polite or PC or not want to start a scene. And that's what makes it so funny. Like, especially when he goes into the South in America and he's in these situations and he's being so obnoxious and the people are trying their hardest to be polite and whatever. And I reckon that's really why lots of people are laughing. But then the reading of the film, people go, oh, he showed there was racism in America. And I was like, well, I'm not really sure the material backs that up, but it's like, that's a more comfortable thing to kind of feel, like to, you know, so you can watch and not feel so bad.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Borat, because I was wondering, because Borat, it ended up getting a lot of criticism from people in it because of the way the producers went about getting the interviews, and they used a lot of subterfuge. And I was wondering, have you ever dealt with that when you've got people onto your show? Like, we were talking about David Irving, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
We couldn't believe that he agreed. Sure,
he didn't actually expect to have a gas pipe.
Yeah, what was the context that you used to get him on the show? Was there subterfuge? And what's the ethical considerations in getting people on into a documentary?
Often I reckon I get away with it and the people aren't angry because... or even most of the times, because once the final thing's put together, often, or most of the times, I'm looking like the idiot as opposed to them.
Yeah, so
I think in this weird way, I often get away with it, even by people who are kind of nominally pranked, because the context of the final thing is so much effort has been made to make me the stooge.
Yeah, well, the joke's often on you.
Yeah. So, but it is... And that's just because I find a lot of things that are kind of similar to my work a bit kind of... I blush a bit and I'm embarrassed, like, when it gets a bit pious or whatever. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. You do things like, for instance, I heard that the way that Ali G got into the FBI and got to talk to people in the FBI is he was brought in as if he's the sound guy. And then...
The What Kind of Acid Is It That Makes You Fly episode.
I can't remember the details. But he's like just a sound guy. And then they've got the cameras set up and there's some other guy who's meant to be doing the interview or something. And then he just sits down and then goes, oh, I'm going to check the sound and all this stuff like that. And then he starts a conversation with the guy as Ali G and then da-da-da-da-da.
And then he's sort of in the trap.
Yeah, and then that's how you kind of capture it. And a way you can do it is you hide what you need for the piece in a big buffered on either side by all sorts of other conversations.
Okay.
So, you know, you're talking, in my case, talking to the Ku Klux Klan, and I might have a half-hour conversation at the start about all sorts of things, half-hour conversation at the end about all sorts of things, and then I've in the middle is the thing that I needed. And so that sort of like hides it a bit from them.
So is there an ethical line though? Does it depend on the subject in terms of how far you're willing to conceal your motives?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases, for instance, if you kind of put yourself out there as I'm running the Ku Klux Klan, I'm not sure some comedian coming in and kind of being a bit of a goofball for 5 minutes is... like the worst thing in the world. I've got really bad, not that I've got bad, but like I definitely do think, I feel this obligation to try to make myself look like the goofball often. Like,
and you
in
find
most
that,
cases.
That actually gives you some cover. So you're talking about Borat before, and Sacha Baron Cohen more generally. One of the things about his characters is you can't actually seriously criticize them because he never meant to be taken seriously in the first place.
Yeah.
So he gets away with a whole lot that Okazaki in this film cannot get away with. He doesn't have the cushion of comedy. So if you take that away, your ethical boundaries change.
I think so. At the very least, the expectations of audiences, I think if you frame it in comedy, they'll give you a lot more leeway. And I think even the subjects that you prank give you a lot more leeway because they, I mean, it depends what you do to them, but, you know. Like for instance, Steve Price, who was a shock jock or a broadcaster on 3AW, and I did this elaborate kind of prank on him where it's too much of a long story, but I made out there were these 3AW ecstasy tablets going through Melbourne or whatever, and he kind of got wind after we'd pranked him that there was this big prank, and there was this huge build up for weeks, like him going, listen, I'm going to have my legal people watching this and da 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 da. And then the final thing, just because it was like funny, like we never heard from him, and then I think he even said to someone that he thought it was funny. So yeah, it's definitely really handy being a comedian.
Well, I think like it leads on to the next film.
I guess the other thing I would say is that you can't just look at like one little genre and say, oh, what's the manipulation there? As if all sorts of things don't have, you know, like a newspaper article or a magazine article or...
Sure, yeah.
Like, well, so it's not like there's this one isolated incident where, oh, you know, Borat and The Chaser and John Safran sort of like slightly present things in this distorted way that's not exactly 100% what is out there in the world. Because you might even say that we give signifiers by being comedians that what we are presenting is, you know, not entirely what's happening in the real world, unlike a newspaper article or a straight documentary.
Mentioned the Michael Moore connection, and Roger and Me is the next film that he's selected to talk about, and that was his first film made in 1989.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see a lot of the seeds for who he would become and his style of quote-unquote journalism coming through in this film, and then later on with a bit of perspective, how he's managed to massage it and nuance it and really refine the formula into something that really gives a lot of punch and oomph.
Yeah.
So in this film, he basically pursues Roger Smith, the head of General Motors, and it's basically due to a whole lot of people who have lost their jobs in Michigan. And that's basically the point, to try and talk about unemployment and to try and get Roger. And it's almost like the Okazaki kind of chase for the guy who's guilty in a lot of senses.
Yeah, absolutely. Like if you're watching Roger and Me and you're saying, where did that all come from? As soon as you see Emperor's Naked Army marches on, you go, that's where it all came from. But yeah, and this is a fantastic film, and I guess one thing I found really interesting, because as his work went on, and because it was so left-wing, right-wing, and the internet blew up so anyone could type in and reveal things, like, the right really tried hard to sort of, like, point out all these lies, like in Bowling for Columbine or Fahrenheit
9/11
and Sicko, and they go through it with a fine-tooth comb, go, oh, this is a misrepresentation, that's a misrepresentation, that's a mis... I spoke to this filmmaker called Debbie Melnick on my Triple J show, because she'd done a film called Manufacturing Dissent, which was, she'd gone out to do a pro-Michael Moore documentary, and then she kind of found out more and more, and it kind of turned into this Michael Moore expose. But it's hard to explain. It doesn't come across like a Fox News thing. It comes across as totally sincere, like she loved this guy and wanted to do this film, and then she just found out things, so she was basically a bit naive. And anyway, in this film, she talks about all these tricks he does in Roger and Me, which I kind of found really interesting, because I thought, oh, maybe he started off pretty straight, and then as the pressures and the stakes got higher and whatever, he started fudging things more and more and more and more and more. And but apparently he was just a genius from day one. And he's
a genius in manipulation.
His big genius, which I just thought, you are a genius. Well, and this is according to Debbie Melnick and her film Manufacturing Dissent, is the whole thing with Roger and me is he's trying to meet this guy, Roger, from... What's his
General
name?
Motors. Roger Smith.
Roger Smith from General Motors. And it never happens. He nearly does it. Nearly happens. Then he gets up at a shareholders meeting and his microphone gets turned off.
Yeah, they turn it off, yeah.
Apparently, he got to meet Roger Smith twice. Got two interviews from him.
Wow. Wow.
This is according to Debbie Melnick in her film Manufacturing Descent. And he's just smart enough... Because I would have been the opposite. I would have gone, oh, I didn't get the interview I want. I'm going to somehow fake that I did. But he's, Michael Moore is just so clever. He actually got what he needed, but realised, was able to kind of distance himself like a genius Zen Buddhist monk of fake documentary. And, and kind of be going, oh, this is actually better if I don't put it in. And it was like, and according to her, the scene where his mic is turned off at the shareholders meeting is also just contrivance.
Wow. Because he actually realises more value by not having those interviews in it because it's really painting Roger as this sort of elusive, nefarious kind of villain by association.
Yeah. And for some reason, if I found out he did that on his later films, I'd kind of go, yeah, I get it. And like, especially now in this environment with reality TV and all this fakery and fudgery, I'd get it. But I just think it's incredible that his absolute first film... He was so smart. Yeah, and so
how do you feel about that, though? Do you feel like he crosses the line? Or maybe, do you feel like he's not even making documentaries in the first place? His films are more polemical arguments than documentaries.
I'm sort of the wrong person to ask, because I give a lot of points for being interesting and being original and being funny and being blah. And Michael Moore is clearly, and Roger and Me particularly, is like such a breakthrough film. I there's an aspect where it's good to have tricksters in the world who are trying to fudge things, and so, yeah. If he wasn't brilliant, I'd hate him.
If that film wasn't sloppily, you'd really pick up.
Well, I mean, that's and I've got a really kind of mixed relationship with these films, and I like Sicko the best, and I find some of the stuff he does in Sicko incredibly manipulative.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just get excited at the magic of the connections he makes. And I know that they're not factually true, but I kind of feel like he achieves this type of emotional truth that's distinct from factual truth. He's kind of like, I feel this way, and I have this perspective on the world, and so I'm not really making a factual documentary. And then and I kind of feel like his films are arguments more than documentaries.
I found that with the growth of the internet, even in my career, that as it goes on and people have more access, that you just... don't get away on a practical level as a filmmaker. You've got to be really, because you just don't get away with things. You can't expect people to like keep the secret, or if someone's annoyed by you, like when I started my career, if someone was annoyed by me, like what are they going to do, write a letter to the Green Guide? And the Green Guide may or may not run it but now
you got people tweeting
you get nailed to a crucifix in the Philippines, and like 1 hour later somehow it's filtered back.
Remember that story leaking before.
And then people in the Philippines who are there can get online and say, oh, this is what happened. And so you just, with Michael Moore, he just doesn't get away with things anymore. But
yeah. And he's got such a huge profile. So people, you know, would literally comb through his trash cans, I imagine.
I think you also have to be, when you're a troublemaker, you just have to be nimble and really adapt to new situations. So there's no point... Sacha Baron Cohen or me or Michael Moore moping about how, 10 years ago you used to be able to get away with this and now you can't. You just got to kind of be wily and work out the new way to do the magic tricks.
I think there's not to sound too airy-fairy, but there's different kinds of truth. And the reason why I don't think this sort of fact-checking culture affects someone like Michael Moore is because he's really talking from an emotional truth, and he will come out with an argument and then find facts to fit into it.
Yeah.
So it almost doesn't really matter. I think Bowling for Columbine's his best film. I think that's an absolutely brilliant film. I think it's terrifically well made, but he's not the sort of guy who's going to go out like that person who was saying, I forgot her name, who's actually making a documentary about him, who's going to change his mind at any time. He's never going to change his mind. He's just going to hammer home his point and, you know...
Yeah, yes.
Just damn to hell with it. You know, if you don't like it, that's your problem.
And he's a bit of a... I mean, that's where I'm kind of different, I guess, in that I find I'm always doubting everything all the time, whilst he's coming from some perspective where... he's convinced himself, so it's either true or he believes it's true, that the media is dominated by this Fox News narrative and narratives like Fox News. So I'm just going to belt away. And everyone's going to throw things at me and there'll be things that are wrong, but I won't care. I'll just figure out another way to kind of make out I was never wrong and da-da-da-da-da. And because it's for the greater good. And that's what my friend said to me. My friend was like, Safran, when I was bagging Michael Moore once, she said, Safran, you don't get it. You're like, you live in this freaking bohemian world where, like, you know, you can be all precious and clever or whatever. But that if you're like just a mainstream person and, you know, you watch, Today Tonight and that's more your life and that's more your circle of friends or whatever. Having someone like Michael Moore who's really pretty mainstream and pretty easy to understand and kind of overly simplifies things, but whatever, he's great for kind of getting those people to think about things a slightly different way.
Yeah, and I'm sure he would argue, you know, that, okay, there might have been some misrepresentations in the film, but you know what? Kmart stopped stocking bullets because I made this film.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
That's
sure.
a pretty big achievement. If you're a gun-toting redneck dude with a shoddy and a cat or a dog or whatever the hell they are in South America, maybe you don't really care about that. Maybe that doesn't mean anything for you. But a lot of people actually might go, well, some good was achieved out of all of this.
Sure.
So you're talking about ends and means.
Yep.
So, do you want to jump across to the third film on the list? Interesting one. Africa Addio.
So this is...
Which,
oh, you go first. You're good at doing the IMDb.
This is one I don't really even know. Luke's got some notes there. This is a Mondo film from the 60s that I was really curious about it being on your list, actually. But Luke, you want to give it a rundown?
We're all doing handballs, are we? okay, fine. This is a shockumentary. It was basically directed by two Italian filmmakers. It seems to be at the start of it a historical document film, but you're in for a bit of a world of surprise. It's about the decolonization of Africa, and it was made in the mid to late 60s, and basically it caused a whole lot of controversy. It was complicated by multiple cuts of the film. So I watched a 128-minute cut. In Norway, there was a 124-minute cut. In Sweden, 116 minutes.
I'm not sure which one I watched.
In the USA, there was a 122-minute cut. And then back in 1970, which the version Roger Ebert savaged, got it all, there was an 83-minute cut, which the filmmakers then
designed. Honestly, I could have done with an 83-minute cut.
just rolling it back a bit, with these filmmakers who... I'll just do their surname. So I... Jacopetti, Cavara, Prosperi. They're the three Italians.
That's why I didn't know that.
They did from what I understand, they did the first one, this film called Mondo Carne, which, and that just means a dog's world, but then the word Mondo kind of got misunderstood or something, and suddenly there was Mondo this, Mondo that, it's Mondo whatever. And again, it's 1962, and it's a time before
Google. And they were 3 years too.
Yeah, and it's a time before Google, and if you're there and just curious about the world, how do you find out about things? And in earlier days, rolling back even more, you know how you hear about these things called like world fairs, and it's like there was the 1890 World Fair, and then
wanted to go to a world fair.
Oh well, yeah,
so good.
So world fair. Like these days, you kind of go, oh, well, what's a world fair, right? But there, if you go back to like 1800, that's like before television, to state the obvious, before film, before lots of things. And the World Fair was like Google. It's like they'd set up this fair that would say, oh, listen, over in Egypt, we'll bring over these things from Egypt, we'll bring over these things from deepest, darkest Africa, we'll bring over these other things. And you'd walk through this fair, you know, back in the 1890s, and like find out about the world. It'd be like the version of Google. How else would you find out about all this madness that was going on all over the world? Anyway, these Mondo Carne films were sort of, I think, a development from that, like from the 1960s, where all these things that are parts of popular imagination now, like, oh, Koreans eat dogs, for instance.
That's not true.
Well, no, probably is true. But this Mondo Carne, all these things that we kind of madly Google when we hear about, this Mondo Carne film kind of did that. They went around the world and took little snapshots of all these amazing things that people otherwise would never be able to see or know about. No DVDs, no YouTube or whatever. And then people would turn up to this cinema in the 60s and they'd go, oh my God, that's happening in China. Or that's happening in over there in Nepal. And that's happening. And these guys were total schlockmeisters and sort of realized, they're like schlock versions of National Geographic, where it's like, oh, what people really want.
And scary schlock versions.
Yeah.
There is an intellectual side of this that's very manipulative.
Yes.
And I mean, I would say this is not a film for animal lovers.
No.
There's so many different animals. Basically, every kind of African animal gets butchered and speared. There's like deers running around with spears coming out of their asses.
There's
elephants being cut up. This guy who like holds up a chicken at the start, and I'm thinking, in the Western world, does that happen? Do people like go off to the KFC, you get your two-piece feed, you come back with the drumstick, you're waving that around, you got your potato and gravy, you start a revolution. And then there are also these horrible scenes of massacres and of bodies, like huge crater-sized like areas of land stocking corpses. And there's this one that's seen that's actually quite incredible. They're flying around capturing these graves in a helicopter that's being shot at by people, you know, down on the ground. They're actually shooting at the filmmaker, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he sort of turns the camera and the helicopter driver's like giving him a big thumbs up. I was like, what am I watching? And then I progressively turned against the narrator of this film because I found him absolutely racist.
Yeah.
And what he was trying to do really like repugnant. He was basically trying to say, you know, it's like a voice of God narration just taken to this ridiculous level.
So are you saying, I haven't seen years, are you saying that because the film nominally is about the whites pulling out of Africa and the consequences of that? So you reckon the narrator was saying, oh, look how it's all falling apart once white man leaves?
I think that was a big part of it. Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. There's one montage of these animal massacre moments that then cuts directly into this scene where white people come and rescue elephants. And they put like a thermometer, you know, under the tusk. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe you actually did that.
Who knows what's... In number two, apparently, in Monday Carne number one, it was a smash hit. And so they did Monday Carne number two. And then it was like, they decided to get a bit flexible. So apparently in Monday Carne two, as a guy self-immolates, you know, a Buddhist protesting China or something, and apparently it's just not, you know, they got an actor to do it and stuff. So
and that's the only scene that they admitted to faking. Yeah. Although it's been questioned, I guess.
I just find it more interesting that there was such schlockmeisters and such P.T. Barnum kind of thing, and you know, just basically everything that's happening on the Shire or everything that's happening on Jersey Shore or on Kim Kardashian's show. It's like Jacopetti, Cavara and Prosperi were doing the same routine back in the 1960s over with Monday Carne and also over in Africa with Adiol Africa.
Talking about carnage and sex, there's not so much of it in the next film we're going to talk about, Catfish. It was released in 2010 by directors Henry Yost and Ariel Schulman, produced by Andrew Jarecki, who made a film called Capturing Freedoms, which is a really fantastic documentary. And Catfish is basically about this guy who starts up a romance with somebody online on Facebook. I don't know how she added him as a friend or how it actually started off. Oh, there was an art connection or something. He bought a picture or something. Anyway, they start off this romance and evidently had the nous to film it from the very beginning. And basically they try and explore, discover who this woman is. They find that there's a video or an audio clip actually that's sent to them of her doing a cover of a song. They find one on the internet that's almost exactly the same. And then they start to ask themselves, actually, is this person who she says she is? I remember there was an old New Yorker cartoon, and it was actually quite a famous cartoon. It had a dog behind a keyboard, and the caption was something like, you never know who you're talking to on the internet. And I think Catfish is the documentary that really got people talking about, hey,
yeah,
you're not quite sure who you're talking to. Just because you see an avatar and you see a name, they could be virtually anybody. And this film sort of explores that to some weird and scary and fantastic degrees.
I think Catfish raises some interesting questions about how much you can fictionalize a story when making a documentary. Because what I feel with Catfish is that I think almost the entire first half of the film is a construct. I think the end of the film and the final result, maybe they did stumble across that. And then they kind of retconned and retconned the story and went, okay, but we'll create this story.
With the willingness of the person that they discovered. So she was complicit in it.
Well, I think the confrontation scenes near the end are reasonably authentic.
Mm.
But I don't think that the discovery sequences that build up to it...
If that is true, then isn't it like the gold in it was true?
Well, that's the thing, though. And that's why it doesn't particularly bother me. I see documentary as fiction in many ways in terms of that you're constructing a story. And so where do you stand with Catfish in terms of...
Oh, well, first of all, it's like a lot of these films, like whatever you think about them, you're thrown in and it's like a roller coaster, like the most amazing ride, and you just so go along with it. Yeah. So Catfish was like that. I just found it like... I was real invigorating.
It's a great story.
And like amazing and really confusing, and I couldn't stop watching it whilst I was watching it and all that. But yeah, it does seem... it's kind of hard to know what to say. But there is something about it where... I guess this isn't a way to live a moral life, but I find things like Catfish where there's not piety behind it a lot easier to kind of forgive or accept or not care if they've constructed things more than... like the piousness of Michael Moore kind of huffing after Charlton Heston and with these fake shots of, what about the little girl who was shot? That's more a taste thing than a moral thing.
That's the photograph scene.
Yeah.
Luke loves that Emperor's scene. Naked Army Marches On. Yeah. So there's a scene in Emperor's Naked Army Marches On.
Whole scene. That's
Her, this dead person's brother, carries a photograph and just lets it sort of rest on his knee. And it means that whatever you ask about this passed away person, it takes on this really big, much more gravity because you've got a picture of them. And he did that quite memorably with Charlton Heston and the girl who died.
Yeah, yeah.
And the association in your mind is that somehow he's responsible for the girl's death, which I guess is the argument that's being made. But I thought what's particularly interesting, I think, historically, although it hasn't been that far, it's been 2 years, with Catfish, is that it's been part of this, the real or not umentary movement.
Yeah.
Where actually people are starting to, it's not just about fudging the truth, it's that we're actually going to fold them into each other. So it's just indistinguishable. And Joaquin Phoenix's I'm Still Here is a really brilliant example of that. And Exit Through the Gift Shop
film of 2010. I absolutely loved Exit Through the Gift Shop. And that did a similar thing. The truth of what you saw in that film just was really a question in terms of whether or not Banksy constructed things. And similar to Catfish, I don't particularly care. Like, it doesn't bother me. If the story's really good and the point is well made, it doesn't particularly bother me when... a documentary is much more fictionalized than people would be led to believe, because I feel like it's all fiction in the end, like it's all storytelling.
The just last week I saw Hale. Emile Corden Wilson, and it's about this prisoner, a real prisoner or former prisoner called Danny P. Jones, and this film is his life story, but he's playing himself about when he was released from prison. And his girlfriend is his girlfriend, and it's kind of the story, but you don't know what is the story and what isn't, and it's maybe everyone's got an on-screen life and it, you don't know what's real anymore. And you can't avoid it now because there's just iPhone cameras and Instagram and Facebook, and so everyone's part of this world now where there's... like a fictional... there's a version of your life based on your life.
And you did it yourself in Race Relations. You fictionalized your own story and recreated kind of anecdotal stories from your head that, like, I don't know if they're exactly how things happen to you, or they might be how you remember them. I don't even know. But, yeah, that idea of just kind of recreating a story and it being the sense of what happened. I find that really interesting.
And I wonder, I've never had the guts to do it the other way, because sometimes it's kind of fun doing it the other way where it's really the truth and then you kind of bullshit and pretend it's fiction. So like Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which everyone forgets is not a true story. Or, but it is.
It is, yeah.
but he's like, oh, like, you know.
That blurs the line brilliantly.
Yeah. It's like, you know, his name's not Hunter S. Thompson, the main character that everyone now thinks the name lead character is Hunter S. Thompson. Yeah. So I just kind of, I've never had the guts to do that because there's just so much mileage and energy in kind of, and in a great way, in sort of like, this is the truth, people. And like, and then sort of like everyone just being totally baffled and kind of suspecting something's up but not quite knowing and can't quite pin it on you, and then it's
And Fear and Loathing is great because it adds hallucinogenic drugs to a real or not thing. Just takes on this extra level. With Catfish, in terms of like it's okay, a story's a story and that sort of argument, I understand that. But on the other hand, these ethical questions still apply. And particularly, there's a character in this film, the woman, who they sort of discover, and she's a bit mentally ill. And she was definitely giving her okay and her thumbs up and a green light to be in this film. She also has pretty severely disabled kids, too. So I guess, ethically, there's a question of, is it okay to film and invite people onto your project like that, even though they've said yes, but they're also, they've got mental conditions?
Well, I think it depends on how you treat them, because, I mean, the other way is it's good to not exclude people just because they're mentally ill. Mm. And I think the one thing in Catfish that kind of disappointed me, the one thing was the very, 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 very end, because I thought once these guys who are, and they're all like, they're attractive and young and they're well off and they live cool lives, it's in New York, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then when they actually go to the house and find out this woman and just how there's just another America, that's just not their America. And where, like, people are just dealt a hand where they have disabled kids and everything. I thought, I was, like, getting really proud of the filmmaker there, because I thought the point was going to be that, listen, what is our petty little complaints about whether she lied or didn't lie? Like, what does that matter?
Yeah.
She ripped us off. Or she, what does that even add up to when you just see this woman in this world or whatever? But, and then it's all going fine. I thought that was the point. But then they have to add in this frigging bit at the very, very end where they point out she lied to them again, which sort of like is meant to, like, it's something about she lied about her cancer or something. It was something about that.
I know.
And I was kind of disappointed because I thought that meant, because I thought for the first time an American was going to stop being a narcissist and, like, look at someone else besides themselves and learn something. I thought that was going to be the growth. You know, that's what's meant to happen to characters in films. But then right at the very end, you find out, no, they're just going to be jerks who are disappointed that this unfortunate woman with disabled kids minorly kind of bullshitted to them.
And then in real life, they went on to direct Paranormal Activity 3 and 4.
And 4, yeah.
Okay, this is a moral problem with films. Oh. Am I allowed to talk about another film?
Yeah, let's throw the floor open.
This is,
and many let's just,
because I recently interviewed this guy called Joe Berlinger, who directed the Paradise Lost trilogy.
Yes,
great trilogy.
And that's about, a lot of people would have heard this, about these three kids that got labelled the West Memphis Three in the early 90s in West Memphis, Arkansas. This kid was killed, and these three kids who were into, like, metal and wearing dark clothing, or at least one of them, and his two mates, they were thrown in jail, and they were convicted, and one was even going to be sentenced to death. And then this doco crew turned up, and it sort of became apparent that maybe they were innocent, and maybe, like, as corny as it sounds, living in inner city Melbourne, maybe there is this other America where things are treated so cornily that if you wear a pentagram on your coat, that actually makes you suspect, you know? Anyway, so over these three films, because I kept on revisiting it, you know, the story became that they were innocent, and then they were finally released, I think, last year, or maybe even this year.
I think last year.
Yeah, they were released last year under this weird law.
They say they're guilty, but they're not guilty.
Yeah, if they admitted their guilt, they could be freed, and so it was this really uncomfortable
moment. So the police don't actually have to find the killer, pretty much.
Yeah.
But one thing I found interesting in the film, I brought up with Joe Berlinger, and he got really angry at me. And me. I'm really bad at, I get kind of, I somehow manage to make people angry when I interview them, when I'm not trying to. But one thing about this film is, in the first film, I was left with the impression that a certain freaky guy was the guilty party. And I reckon the film was cut in that way.
Yeah.
And I talked to other people. I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
Everyone I talk to agrees with that, right?
Yeah.
Then suddenly in number three, I can't remember what happened in number two.
But the second film was almost completely about that freaky guy.
Yeah. But then suddenly in this one that was released just last year, suddenly...
You got a whole new suspect.
There's a whole new suspect. Yeah. And it's like... And I said to him, I go, well... Like, considering that the original point was don't judge people by appearances and whether they're quirky, is there something that you've done, Joe Berlinger, where you've judged this person because they're freaky and quirky, and then you've obviously changed your mind? And he could just, because there's no, you know, voiceover, he could just play on this bullshit thing where he goes, well, I never said blah, and we never said in this film blah either, and he just kind of had plausible deniability.
For him, it's probably more about, like, the good talent. So you've got this, like, really kind of yokel, extravagant guy who seems guilty of something. You know, if it's maybe just idiocy.
But was that his argument that we never said?
Yeah, that was his argument.
Okay, because
that's dodgy.
It felt like, because I know that those films are really fascinating in the way that they slowly over the course of the three incorporate the filmmaker's influence as well. Because the first one is pretty kind of verite, and it's pretty third person, and the filmmakers aren't really part of it, and then they inevitably become part of the story as it goes along. So the second one, the filmmakers are very much part of the story, and it's very much an accusation that, well, I think it could be this guy, and I find it pretty disingenuous that he even said that.
And there's huge things that were left out of the film that he was really annoyed at me for bringing up. And having said that, like, I love these films.
I think that they're a brilliant example of documentary cinema.
I went online and I was trying to figure out, when you watch these films, you're going, oh, is there a missing piece that they're leaving out of here or whatever? And the main guy that they spent three movies making the protagonist, he was like, they had mental treatment done and all this stuff. And that never comes up in any of the films. Mm. And he kind of made out, Joe just said to me, he goes, oh, you can't cover everything in the film. And I sort of going, well, you had like... What, 6-9 hours, and it's about whether this guy is a killer or not a killer.
A large running time, really. Yes. And that goes back to what we were talking about before, about participation from people who have mental problems, who might be saying, yeah, film me, but there might be some other ramifications to that. And there was a really good film out a couple of years ago called Resurrect Dead, The Mystery of the Toynbee Tiles. And it's basically, it's a bit of a long title, but it's about the Toynbee Tiles, these tiles that were planted all around America, like in the middle of the road, like the crosswalks, everywhere. And it sort of started this movement of people trying to find out who did it. And these guys kind of link it back through all these weird and bizarre connections. And finally, you know, they find the guy, and they realize that he really doesn't want to be found. So then the filmmakers tussle with this decision, do we expose him or do we just let him live his life?
Yeah.
And their answer is, we're not going to actually introduce ourselves to him because we're not ethically comfortable with that.
Wow.
And that's a really interesting reversal of that whole idea of fair game and gotcha and this man or person on a mission. It's like these guys went on the mission, they found a result, and they realised, no, it's actually ethically wrong to include it.
Having said that, it did make for a disappointing ending.
More ambiguous than disappointing.
Yeah.
That sounds a bit like in Grizzly Man, where there's a fantastic scene. He's a bit like Michael Moore, Werner Herzog, where he just knows how to do things that I wouldn't do because I'd be too excited about trying to make it all tabloid and exciting. And they try to pull it back because they realise that can be powerful. So in Grizzly Man, where he gets the audio of is it brilliant her scene. Son?
It's her husband, isn't it? Isn't it her husband or her brother?
Yeah, of being eaten
by the bear.
Eaten by the bear, and he's got the audio, but rather than playing it to us, the audience, he just lets her listen to it on the headphones, and then he says, you must destroy this tape.
Yeah, yeah. Destroy this tape. Is that cake and eat it too?
I know. He's genius. He's great.
There was the end of The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I think his most recent film, his second most recent film, and it ends up with him ranting about albino alligators.
Yeah, and he just tangents.
Wow, this is weird.
Just closing off that Paradise Lost thing, I was thinking about how, for me, maybe this is self-serving considering my shtick, but I actually find that white kind of film where you pretend you're just doing something impartial and there's no voice to it, and it's like this, we're just presenting you as a truth, way more morally dubious than Borat or me. Because like in that one, he's actually saying he's directing that this guy is guilty, and then being able to say, well, I never said that because I was just presenting the truth. And it's like, well, the truth changed between Paradise Lost 1 and Paradise Lost 3.
And no one had to say it in direct terms. It was the voice of the film in the sense of the voice.
You're going down, Berlinger.
Yeah, well, and it's disingenuous to say that the film doesn't have a voice just because you're not with the voice over saying that.
Yeah.
But that's interesting that you brought that up, because I was going to ask you, would you have any intention in making a documentary that you weren't in as a subject? Could you even do that?
Yeah, if you had time. You're not going to believe it because you're going to think, like, I'm a narcissist or whatever. But often, just because of the stuff I do involves going overseas, and you have to do things really quick and fast, and you have to just be clever and make sure you have stuff to then cut into a show. Like, one of the ways to kind of higher the ratio of success is to write a story arc where you, in some ways, control the story arc.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I kind of shove myself into things so much. It's like, because it's like back at home before we go overseas, it's like, if we're going to get on a plane with all this equipment and spend so much money, we've got to make sure there's something. So you kind of write a story arc, which, you know, you can deviate from once you're there. But the fact that I'm driving it just kind of means you can write something where kind of this will happen and this will happen, and that will have something.
So it's more about time and resources.
Yeah, I think so. But also, but I don't know, it's also just, I don't know, when I'm like, as I said, I'm reading all these true crime books, and I often like when there's the presence of the author in it, and it's not always like it just gives it some anchor or some grounding or something.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned with the first Paradise Lost that you find it a bit more dubious when they're not present.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, there is a lot more honesty to admit that there is a filmmaker present, and...
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of people kind of have argued that postmodern flow into the filmmaker becoming the subject is more truthful than that old-fashioned kind of fly-on-the-wall type cinema, because the camera is going to affect what's there, so why not just completely turn it around?
But that's also the thing I was talking at RMIT about doco-making and other doco-makers, is this assumption that if everyone's acting all pious, that's the truth. So I saw this documentary recently just at the Melbourne Film Festival, My House. It's about the prison system in America. And the guy, one of the talking heads in it, he didn't direct it, is the guy who wrote The Wire. And, you know, anyway, it's a really good documentary, really interesting. I'm not criticizing it on that level. But, you know, all the black people who are in prison and out of prison and that they talk to, and the poor white people they talk to, they're all like really like pious and discuss their lives as if everything's got this political reason that they're living their life this way or discussing this. And it's all very... And it's just like, I've never met anyone in the world who like talks like that, or their life is that. It's like, it's just not the truth.
Yeah.
And I spent 6 months in Mississippi last year on this thing and met lots of poor white people. I never bumped into one person who the way they construct their lives is in that way or talk that way. So it's not like, but comparing his film to something like what I do, people would go, well, you're the one who's fudging things, John, because you've imposed all this comedy into it. It's like, that earnestness is a fudge, because no one is freaking talks like that or is that earnest or only sees their life that way.
There's a total pretense to that type of material. Yeah.
So probably just defending my people, the wacky comedian documentary makers, is like maybe our comedy, you know, flags to people that it's not all, you know, quite as it seems, and that's more honest in its dishonesty.
And does give you a convenient escape clause.
Yes, it does.
Because if things get a bit hairy, you can go, oh, it was a joke.
Yeah, it was a joke.
Lighten up. I didn't mean to kick this poor African
kid in the head.
Yeah.
Well, that just shows how honest I am.
You're talking about when
I accidentally kicked a soccer ball into this kid's head.
Indeed.
In Mozambique. And I put it in. You see, that's my problem. That's my fatal flaw.
You not only put it in, but you did a rewind slow motion.
Slow motion replay.
That's my strength and my weakness. Like, I can't resist putting it in, so I guess it gets a bit more honest. But then I've got a scene where I kick a small black kid in the head with a soccer ball in my documentary.
I think that's a good note to end on. I'm so happy that you've come to talk to us, John. It's been really great.
Thank you for inviting me to your flat.
And with, the soccer ball in the head.
Yeah.
So it's a good segue into an exit. Yeah, thanks very much for joining us, John. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.